This is the EWN Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to Empowering Motherhood Radio. I'm so glad that you're with us. Today we've got they're all my favourite topics, but this is one of my favourite topics as well. Today joining us is Dr. Penny Griffin, and she has a PhD in politics and international relations and a specific interest in feminism. And I've just found it that with motherhood in particular, you know, the conversation around feminism seems to have died off in some areas, but still very vibrant in other areas. She's also has a publication, Popular Culture, Political Economy and the Death of Feminism, Why Women Are in Refrigerators and Other Stories, which we'll ask her a little bit about in a moment. But it's looking at what's called the post-feminist era, and asking if feminism is irrelevant. Now, given the definition of feminism, that it's a feminist is a person who believes in the social, political and economic equality of the sexes, it's hard to understand how it could possibly be dead in the water. So welcome to the show, Penny, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And so what's your immediate comment around the term, I guess, post-feminist? Like, you know, how would you talk about a post-feminist era, that term?
I am a little bit cynical around what it might mean, in the sense that post indicates that we've somehow gone beyond feminism, and I don't think that's true in any sense. But I think also there might be a political agenda that wants to move away from some of the negative connotations of perhaps more radical forms of feminism. So I'm not totally decided, but I would suggest that it's a bit of a marketing ploy to keep, I suppose, empowerment quite closely related to women's consumption choices. And so I'm a bit sceptical about how we might apply post-feminism.
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally agree with you. It's you know, we're still... How can that discussion ever go away, really? And if we're having, when you're saying about, you know, our consumer choices, not only in what we buy, but what stories we buy about ourselves. And I know in motherhood, a lot of the women that I work with that have a lot of anxiety and even postnatal depression, you know, their expectations of what they thought it was going to be like, which often comes from the media, it comes from advertising, it comes from this image that we even put out about ourselves, that we've got it all together and everything's good, and this sort of surface, you know, facade, yet underneath that is a completely different story. So what have you seen in relating to that, like, you know, the facade of a woman or feminism and what's actually going on underneath there? In reality, for women,
it's really hard because I think women today are probably more isolated and they feel more personal pressure to be everything. And there's this myth that feminists have told women that they can have it all, and actually no feminist has ever said that. But the media has seized this agenda of women's equality and equated it to women working professionally at very high levels while still carrying on the kind of traditional basis of femininity, if you like. And I think for most women, especially nowadays where women are having babies probably after a bit of a time working, the actual pressures of what that might mean and how there's constant judgment on every aspect of their lives. There's a kind of romantic Hollywood ideal of the nuclear family. There are visions of good and bad motherhood that women are surrounded with in all aspects of their lives. But there's very little engagement with what it might actually mean to be in a in a society that's more individualistic, more consumption orientated, that's perhaps a bit emptier, and women only have themselves really to talk to in that respect. And I know for me, my expectations didn't match the reality, but learning to tell yourself that that's okay, and you might need to find alternatives, and there will be opposition to those, is quite hard for a lot of women.
Yeah, it is. It can be a real drop in, okay, my expectations were up here, and then, oh, this is the reality, actually. And what I've found is that a lot of us, you know, keep up this facade. So when we're out, we look, you know, we have to look like we have it all together. And so then everyone else thinks everyone else has it all together. yet at the same time, what's actually going on is that we're all often, you know, many women are isolated at home and crumbling when they walk back in the door. Although some women even get to a point where they barely can go out because they can't even hold up the facade anymore. And so therefore it's not even okay, you know, to go out if you can't, you know, frock up and show up and look like you've got it all together. So, you know, just, I know you, like, you've had your baby. How old's your little one now? 18 months? Two? Is she two yet?
Yeah, she'll be two on Monday, next Monday.
Oh, really? Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
She's so cute. so did you find that a little bit for yourself with trying to, when you had your baby, that the stuff that, because you've been researching and working in this area for a while, so when you actually had your baby and had your own experience, what came home for you there?
It's at the same time that motherhood is kind of the most natural thing in the world and is described like that, it's also described as the hardest thing that you'll ever do. And I think that for me personally, that there was a huge shift in identity that I didn't anticipate being so challenging. And motherhood is really hard, and it doesn't have to be, and it's made hard because we're kind of surrounded by choices that are problematic and people that will make us feel guilty, whatever decision we make, or misinformation and lots of hostility to certain options and the whole kind of conventional narrative about what families look like and what they should mean. And loads of women don't live in conventional families or have kind of the traditional nuclear family supporting them. And it just, I'm always a bit saddened that the media agenda is dominated by a very specific vision of what is appropriate for a woman or a mother to be, or how they should behave, or what they should expect. And I just find constantly that my desires never quite map onto the rest of the world. That sounds a bit
domestic. And that almost adds another layer, doesn't it? So, you know, we've gone from talking about the facade and what's really going on, and we've been sold this image, and then that's a whole nother layer of thinking, oh, why don't I want that? why isn't that what I'm, you know, am I supposed to feel bad because I'm not wanting to strive towards this image in Hollywood, in the media, even, you know, in advertising? That's a whole nother layer, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And most of our life is a compromise. I think if you work, and even if you don't work as well, there are choices that you have to make that you kind of learn to be comfortable with, but they're not necessarily intuitive, or there's lots of guilt, or there's kind of options that you wish you had open to you, but you just don't. So you just have to do the best with what you've got. But as soon as motherhood is mentioned, every choice that a woman makes is open to some kind of public debate or scrutiny, and it's that that really troubles me.
Yeah, it really is. And are you finding, you know, as you do your research and as you're going through your own experience, that it's more so around motherhood than other areas of life for men or for women in other places?
I don't know. I think it really depends on context. Yeah, because there's, especially if you're white and privileged and living in a relatively rich country like Australia, I will be faced with the sorts of choices that are very specific to my environment and that someone somewhere else really doesn't have to deal with, and they have their own sort of obstacles. And so it's kind of difficult to say, but I think there's such a mythology around motherhood, and there's so many social expectations and histories of accomplishment and medical interventions, and we have a whole system that regulates women in terms of motherhood, being a mother, bringing up children. And I think of all aspects of my life, it's been the most challenging and the one where I think, oh my goodness, feminism is so important here.
That it's really important now in this time of your life. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to have the conversation, and back to something that you touched on earlier about the negative connotation of the word feminist or feminism. So, you know, what's been your experience around that? Well, expand on that a little bit for us about, you know, what's going on in society around the, you know, often negative connotation around the word.
Yeah, it really struck me when I was beginning the book. So this was about sort of 2008, 2009, and it was before Julia Gillard gave her misogyny speech, and it was a bit of time before the kind of the invisible, unconscious obstacles that women face was really debated and quite effectively in the Australian media. And I was teaching undergraduates and postgraduates, and quite often I noticed a palpable discomfort among my students if I asked them how they would articulate or what they understood by feminism or whether it was anything that they found relevant in their lives. And there was this kind of constant, I'm not a feminist, but I think violence against women is awful, or I'm not a feminist, but the gender pay gap is really problematic and we should do something about it. And there was this sort of overt discomfort with articulating as feminist. And I've been there as well, so I know that I think a lot of that comes from the reproduction in popular culture of assumptions about what it means to be a feminist or to support feminism. And this picture of the kind of the bra-burning feminazi is really pervasive, and it was certainly when I was beginning the book, and there were a lot of negative connotations. And if you watched any kind of Hollywood film, the token feminist would always be some undesirable woman who had problems socializing and didn't like men. And I think my students felt really uncomfortable with being seen as that so much of their lives is how they represent themselves and what they look like and what they seem to be to the world. And I think that caricature is really strong still, but I think we've had better examples since, really I think since Julia Gillard, for whatever reasons, and I know that a lot of people think that she was very calculated with that speech. But the misogyny speech really brought out into the open, I think, how a lot of women in Australia felt about their professional and their personal lives, and that we had a figurehead, a prime minister who was openly misogynistic, I think really troubled a lot of women, and the media had some really interesting debates about it. And for me in Australia since then, I've noticed a bit of a sea change, that people, my students in particular, but people generally are much more open to thinking around the possibilities of what feminism is about, that it's not necessarily how you present yourself to the world, but it's the sorts of core values that you reproduce in your interactions with the world that matters. And so I think it's actually better than it was. For all the bad things that happen, I find that Australia at the moment socially, and my students' engagement with their world is more constructive than it was, say, 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I've also had a few other big things happen in sort of world media in that time as well, you know, with, you know, breastfeeding a toddler on the front of a, you know, I can't remember which magazine it was in America, and everyone's got something to say about that, and it was, you know, put there to shock and to create a conversation, and the fact that it does shock and create the conversation is another conversation in itself. And then there was another, what's her name, the singer with her nipple falling out, Janet Jackson, you know, her nipple falling out at the, when she was singing at the Super Bowl, and, you know, the whole conversation was about, she had to apologise, you know. But then a lot of, I guess also with social media, a lot of discourse can really come out quite quickly about our reaction to these things. And almost, you know, put a lid on some of the, you know, old school ways of thinking, I guess, or the, you know, actually have a discourse around it. Well, hang on a minute. She was, you know, is that actually a crime for your nipple to pop out of your top when actually everyone wanted the top to be as low as possible, as close to the nipple, but don't let it come out, you know? But there's been quite a few big incidents that have happened that have really brought up a lot of conversation around around women through this popular culture as well, hasn't it? So is it a bit of a, you know, at one side we're being marketed at to consume this image of ourselves and this expectation of ourselves and this sort of ideal lifestyle. And then on the other hand, there's this, you know, more open platform for a conversation around it. Are you finding that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's a much more diverse array of representations of women around. And I know it's really easy to look for the really kind of troubling hate speech on social media, but it's also really exciting to see the sheer quantity of people doing unusual things and being supported, and women presenting themselves in ways that they're comfortable with rather than kind of preordained social roles. And I think in terms of film and television, that there are more representations of women at all stages of their lives, that there are more women having a platform, I suppose, that you hear more voices nowadays. And I think you hear more non-Western voices, which is really important. And there's
I've really noticed that just even recently. Yeah, I've actually noticed that even just over the last couple of weeks, to be honest, in my Facebook feed. I'm getting a lot more stories from places on the planet that normally we wouldn't hear anything about.
No, we wouldn't. And the whole, I think a lot of the elements of politics that worry me in Australia about the kind of the polarisation between tradition and culture and the so-called kind of liberated, civilised West and the way that we look at refugees and migrants in quite racist ways. I think that in terms of looking at feminist work and feminist areas is really, it's really creative, and it's a really constructive engagement with how women live their lives according to the circumstances that they're surrounded by. And you see all kinds of wonderful things that we wouldn't have had any access to. And it's just this kind of this constant subversion of what it means to be a liberal democracy and actually to take people's lives seriously. If we weren't surrounded by that, I think that we would think that everything was fine in Australia, that women have won the battle and there's no kind of work to be done. And because we know there's so much information and there's so many resources, that we can really see that actually women live their lives in multiple ways and face a huge number of challenges wherever they are. And I always tell my students that we need to be really careful to criticize other cultures for flaws that are really endemic in our own. We just kind of stop seeing them because we let these assumptions about the liberated kind of civilized world color our vision sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit not wanting to see what's happening in your own backyard sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, there's some really shocking things that happen here. And then there are things like a woman breastfeeding on a magazine, and how is that even news? And you kind of wonder who's directing the research and whose interests are being served by the way that we're given information here, in the mainstream media anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And as we all know, the mainstream media is quite limited as far as where the source all comes from. You know, which is another blessing of social media, I guess, and being able to get a broader perspective through searching through the internet. So what about when we talk about stereotypes of women, there's also the stereotypes of men. And how does that come back to affecting, you know, feminism or our place in society?
For me, feminism is really about paying attention to the apparently trivial, kind of mundane, intimate aspects of our lives and working out kind of what they're doing, whose power is invested in kind of the tiny choices that don't even kind of make it onto the political agenda. And so looking at the way that men are privileged and disadvantaged is part of the puzzle. It's not just that we can generalize about women's lives or what motherhood might be, it's that we actually pay proper attention to what's happening at a micro level in terms of how they are enabled or not to make particular choices. And then at the macro level, looking at the sorts of structures of bias, of discrimination, of privilege that don't just only disadvantage women, they also disadvantage men. And in Australia, there's a very strong macho, ideal, white, sort of upper working class, lower middle class masculinity that acts as this sort of galvanizing force across popular culture. And that's not just damaging to women, it's really damaging to all the men that don't behave in ways that are traditionally kind of Aussie male. And so I don't think any good feminist would ever think that the story was only about women, if that makes sense, that they really care about people's lives and making those lives better.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, and that's a whole nother discussion as well, which I'm actually going to be having next week with a male.
Okay.
So, you know, which is about, you know, where men are going and what's happening with their lives and, you know, helping them to, you know, looking, having that discussion around, I guess, bringing that conversation to the table as well about, you know, what is healthy for men and how should we be bringing up our boys and, you know, what's working and what's not working. And there's a whole other story there, isn't there?
Yeah, totally. I think there's a sort of assumption that some people make about feminism, just that it's not interested in men and men's lives and that women's empowerment has to come at the expense of men's privilege, and sometimes in like very elite circles that might be true, but actually on an everyday down-to-earth basis, everyone benefits from a society that's really willing to reflect on its biases and discrimination. But that narrative of feminism as kind of anti-men has been quite strong, and so you see lots of men's groups that believe that women are emasculating men, and there's lots of kind of anti-feminist stuff that I've gone through on the internet, and in my research generally, but really it isn't about a conversation, it's about a fight, and I think that that's a really unhealthy way forward, and I worry if my students reproduce that kind of politics.
Yeah, it is a worry when it's going down that road, and I've actually just done an interview with Ephrat Wolfson, and she, her work's all around conflict resolution, and she was saying that the, you know, whether it's between two countries or two groups of people or a husband and a wife, that it all comes back to the same thing of needing to fully see each other as a full human being and to understand each other's real needs. It's a very interesting conversation. It ties in to what we're talking about here as far as, you know, us seeing other people as a full human and, you know, asking genuinely what their needs are and being able to, you know, really find something that works for everybody, which is what the work that she does. And as she said, sometimes it's complex, but it's not impossible to find things that actually meet everybody, you know, find that middle ground. Well, it's not even middle ground, but find that solution that meets everybody's needs. And, you know, that would be the ideal, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And I really, you cannot enter at any level, any sort of conflict resolution process unless there's both parties willing to show some kind of empathy, that the solution will never be meaningful until people have kind of pulled themselves out of their box and thought about what life looks like on the other side.
Mm. And you know, really that is one of the conversations that we, when we think of feminism, you know, it would be nice if that's what we thought of. You know, that was the conversation of feminism was actually, you know, stepping in someone else's shoes, which, you know, a lot of people are trying to do more and more. So there's parts of society heading in the right direction, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just that sort of curiosity about how the world works, especially in young people, but not only in young people, just keeping that openness to the possibility that everything is different somewhere else or even right next to us is really important.
Yeah, and even as you were saying before, the curiosity from woman to woman in different, in, you know, whether it's in a different suburb or a different country, or, you know, that the problems that they're facing or the needs that they're having at that moment, you know, are different from one person to the other. And I guess that's also become one of the problems with the word feminist, is that it's, you know, it means something different to so many different women.
Yeah, there's it's a really strong and really, I think, solid critique of the sort of white liberal feminism that's imagined the world from privileged women's perspectives. And I think a lot of third world feminists have really rightfully said this is kind of your way of seeing the world and your reproduction, but actually our fight is against sexism, but also class identity, imperialism, the kind of the constant reproduction of the white ideal for motherhood. And I think it's only really been since the sort of late 80s, 90s and onwards that feminism has really sort of broadened its reach, and it's only because of the really important work that women in developing countries in the so-called third world had done to kind of keep saying, hang on a minute, hang on, you're making generalizations, this isn't how we see our lives and this isn't what we aspire to. And that conversation is really important. And there's lots of disagreement, but it doesn't have to be a hostile negotiation. It's about different voices being heard. And I think most people nowadays respect how important that is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a growing awareness that that's happening. So tell us a little bit more about your work that you do on you know, your research and the work that you do at the university as far as linking all of this to international relations and political economy.
Yeah, okay, gosh, big one.
Is that like a 5 minute answer?
Yeah. I'm really interested in looking at the global political economy, so the structures, I suppose, of economic organisation and social life, and how they are created and reproduced according to questions of identity. So who, for example, does the global financial system benefit? Like, what kinds of bodies are privileged there, and why does it matter that only certain types of knowledge or certain people's experiences are used as the basis for kind of bigger generalizations, for example, in development banking about how people live their lives. So I'm really interested in understanding, I suppose, the gender relations that underpin areas that are not conventionally seen as relevant to gender, so global finance, economic development, ideas about globalization and progress and benefit. Kind of putting the people back in, so this is what I try to do. And in my teaching, I'm probably really annoying because I always try and use sort of everyday examples of bigger issues, just to try and get the students to think about how micro and macro and structures and processes and practices all link together and might be relevant to gender scholars.
Yeah, interesting. We were watching the movie about the dark web last night, and just a fascinating, fascinating conversation around, you know, basically trying, on one hand, trying to demonstrate a completely different economical setup, a different structure, and you know. Part of what that story was about is trying to show that it can be done in a different way, but having to do it in the dark web because there's nowhere else that they could actually try and reproduce a real life example. it was absolutely fascinating to look at it from that perspective of, you know, a completely different economical structure, political economic structure within these massive, massive websites in the dark web, which of course are constantly being shut down. Well, they were saying for every one they shut down, you know, 10 or 100 pop up. So I think the saying was that it's a cat and mouse chase. The mouse will win, but the cats will be well fed. but it was just really fascinating on that point of, you know, looking at something from a completely different perspective around politics and economics.
Yeah, it's really, because we live in a state of advanced consumer capitalism, it's become really difficult to see the alternative. Like, our economic system is completely totalizing. It's almost impossible, I think, for my students to imagine, or as it is for me as well, but to imagine what a really alternative system might look like. And then there are all these really interesting points of pressure that the internet offers and kind of sites of subversion. And we probably don't see them as much as we should be because that's kind of where the alternatives really are. And conventional regulatory responses aren't really kind of omnipotent in a way that they might have been 20 or 30 years ago. It's fascinating, the possibilities are really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think if we draw it back to women and to motherhood, you know, something that's fascinating, which is you sitting, where are you? Are you at work or home?
Yeah,
I'm sitting across the other side of the city. I've interviewed people in different countries, different states. You know, and we're able to run our business, you know, from our home, in our time around our family, which is, you know, what I'm able to do. And so that, you know, takes on a whole nother, conversation as well, as about as how this sort of, you know, we're able to use these resources to create yet another story for women.
Yeah, it's amazing, because when I started uni, we had like a little rubbishy intranet, but there was no internet. And now, honestly, I couldn't imagine how possibly I could ever write anything if I didn't have direct access to the internet. My life is controlled by Google, and I can't imagine producing anything meaningful through sitting in a library and reading books that are like at least a couple of years old, and the ideas are older in that. And I have a lot of respect for reading and books. So my poor students who perhaps don't even have my history and engagement with literature, who just their whole lives are mediated by the internet, and we want the information now, and what are we missing, and what are the possibilities? And it's just, it's crazy. There's so much potential, and that there's also the possibility for damage as well. So I think we probably need to be careful.
Yeah, we definitely do. So where are you at now with, you know, with your work, and so how... So where have you come to at the moment with your view on how the status quo at the moment in our society, and what popular culture is, you know, where it's at, what it's feeding us, what we're feeding into it?
I think I started writing the book and I was a bit despondent. I was a bit hopeless about what the possibilities might be. There was lots of feminist bashing and ideas about post-feminism represented by this sort of crude celebrity feminism, which is women empowering themselves through their consumption choices. It's never really been anything that excites me. But I think nowadays I feel that there's loads of really good stuff out there. There's lots of options, and there's lots of ways to connect with people who have similar outlooks on life, and there's still lots of yucky stuff, I think, in the media and on the web and just generally, but there's a lot of really important discourse around girls and what we expect from girls and boys and how to bring up children in a kind of healthy, nurturing way to teach them kind of what is appropriate in terms of what other people do or how they engage with them. I think I noticed a more respectful attitude, I think, to women and the possibilities of being a sort of woman in training as a younger person are. So I'm not as hopeless as I was a few years ago, and I've had lots of really strong engagement from my students. I don't really know totally what shifted it. I think it's everything that we've talked about and all those examples that keep kind of cropping up, and everyone has a history because Janet's boob fell out. But then there's always the conversation about, well, why does it matter? And what is she being expected to achieve? And how could we make a woman's performance, a musical performance, actually not about her sexuality, you know, what might it mean to do that? And those discussions happen quite quickly now, and I don't think they were as immediate a few years ago. So I'm quite positive. I think there's lots of problems in the world, and there's lots of things that I look at and think that's awful. And I worry about bringing beauty into a world where women are treated as they are sometimes, but I feel kind of confident that we can navigate it in a productive way.
Yeah, that's good. So what's your approach then to, in respect to the conversation that we've had with your parenting, upbringing, you know, bringing up your daughter?
I really want, and I think a lot of mothers feel the same, to create a safe space at home to have those conversations that I never had with my parents as soon as possible, to make it really clear around sort of personal, physical boundaries and to not have to just sort of hope that your children are okay. For me, I want to just have a proper conversation with her as soon as she's... I mean, we try at the moment. It's a little bit one-sided. But to not live in fear, so to not think that the world is scary and there are scary people out there, but to know... So it's really important to take responsibility for yourself, to, when you're talking to other people, to always be kind and respectful and to know what your own limits are and to know what your personal boundaries are and how to express carefully and sensitively yourself to the world. That's, I think, for me and Edie, I think that's our most important work.
Yeah, and that comes back to something that you said about being, what was it exactly that you said, just about actually, you know, living it, and the mundane, the small things are things that matter.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, as you're saying about that, that having that conversation, that home being a safe space to have this conversation, and like many of my interviews, one of the solutions comes back to eating at the table, which I want to do a whole show on, you know, because for me, with my children, that's where most of those conversations happen, you know, that we've had that habit for a long time, or always, of eating together at the table, and the conversations that happen there are amazing, and, you know, and that's a part of what you're talking about. Also, picking teenagers up from parties at 1 o'clock in the morning. My husband was complaining that we were the only ones that seemed to do it, and I said, yeah, well, we're the only ones that know what's going on, and, you know, we're the ones that, that the teenagers, in my case mostly the girls, at this stage, you know, they talk to us about this stuff, and we have a chance to talk, you know, I guess prompt them to think about things on a deeper level, you know, whether it's debriefing what happened at the party or something else.
Yeah, that, and I'm sure that they know that they can say whatever they want because they're not being judged as well, and that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And what have you, my one final question, I guess, is just looking at your, so what's interesting about your position is that every year you'll get the next lot of students coming in. Over the years, each year, do you see a shift? In their awareness, in their attitude, in their questioning, their interests, like, you know, do you see this sort of shift each year as the next group come in?
Sometimes.
Or is it universal? The same universal questions coming up.
I think at the moment, and we've noticed this sort of the last 4 or 5 years, but students their lives are increasingly pressured towards knowing the outcome as soon as possible. So they don't have the space, and they probably don't have the financial resources to explore in quite the way that they might have done 10 years ago. But even given that, like our cohort at the moment this year, first years, a really interested and interesting group of students who actually just want to engage with difficult questions and who are really motivated to broaden their horizons. But some years it's not always like that. And I don't know, I think the market at the moment in terms of graduating and entering the job market is. It's quite difficult for young people, and I'm sure they probably have parents who have expectations of where they'll be and how much they'll be earning. So in terms of universities, there's a push to a more business orientated model where students are probably a bit less generous in terms of the labour value of their lecturers and professors. They some students expect that they're buying a degree when they go to university, but that's not all students. And I've definitely in the last 3 or 4 years noticed a softening to really quite difficult, critical questions. So I don't know whether the financial crisis kind of affected the way that people see the world, and economic pressure kind of pushes you to look at alternative ways of thinking more.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, to start looking at that correlation of when, you know, there is a lot of pushes, and I guess each generation is different, has different pressures, different outlook. They're born into a different environment.
Yeah.
And then they've got their predecessors, their parents, with their expectations and their experiences. So it's very interesting to see, just to hear a little bit about, you know, where the kids or the young adults that are coming out of school into university, you know, where their head's at, where they're placing themselves right now. And, you know, that sometimes it's more of a push to, you know, have an outcome and get a job and the money, and then other times a more interest in delving into, the harder questions. It's a really interesting thing to talk about. So I have one last question for you, Penny, which is why women are in refrigerators and other stories. I haven't read your book, so I need you to explain that.
it's a comic book trope. There was a comic book called The Green Lantern, I think.
Yeah.
Shows how bad my memory is. But there is
The Green Lantern, yeah.
I think it's that. But the way that the hero is punished in that comic book is that his girlfriend is murdered and her body is shoved into a freezer. And it became quite a well-known in sort of certain sort of geek circles, which I shamefully inhabit. But it was a mechanism. It was a term applied, so fridging a woman or putting her in a refrigerator was a term applied to any plot device where the hero was attacked through a weak, vulnerable female spouse or sister or some kind of relative, and that plot device of a man kind of reaching his potential through these awful things that happen, but particularly through making women kind of expendable commodity, is actually really common, and it can ruin your whole film life because there are so many films that use women, brutality against women, women suffering as a plot device to further the advancement of the hero. So stuff like Gladiator and Braveheart and pretty much any James Bond film, they all use that trope of fridging women in some way, like making a woman suffer to advance the character of a male. But I also chose it because it's a bit obscure. If you're not in those geek circles, you kind of read it and think, I have no idea what that means. That's interesting.
Exactly, which is why I couldn't wait to ask you what it means. Yeah, that's, now I'm going to watch all those films with your little voice in the back of my head.
Yeah, I'm sorry, it ruins everything.
Don't worry, I live with a cinematographer. Yeah, I live with a cinematographer who already sort of half ruins films with telling me, that lighting's terrible. I'm like, I don't mind, I'm just watching the film. Oh, that's too this, that's too that. Oh, there's, you know, the boom's in the way. Oh, really? I really wouldn't have noticed. dear. Oh, well, that's what happens, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to us. It's been absolutely awesome. So I'll just go through. So your book is Popular Culture, Political Economy and the Death of Feminism by Penny Griffin. And people can, you know, find out more about your book and your work. It's easy to Google that. And it's absolutely fascinating conversation. Love to have more of it. And I hope you and Edie, I'm sure you're going to do the absolutely stellar job of bringing her up to be an awe-inspiring woman. In her way.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it's not too much for her. It can be hard having academic parents sometimes, I think.
Oh, yeah, my daughter's got the same. I actually, last year at football, I came down and the lady doing the sausage sizzle was laughing her head off, and there was my four-year-old. And I was like, oh, sorry, is she entertaining you? And she's like, oh, she's just telling me about how babies are born and placentas and things. So I was like, oh, sorry about that. So, yeah, they're immersed in what you do, and, you know, that just comes back to us trying to be aware of how we're being and how we're living, and so that, and what we're saying, and getting that awareness, which is exactly what you were talking about before, and being able to have those conversations, and that's what they're immersed in, and that's what they'll take on from you into their life. So it's absolutely awesome. All right, Penny, thank you so much for chatting, and I will hopefully see you soon. No worries.
Yeah,
thanks, Penny.
Soon.
Bye.
This is the EWN Radio Network.